Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, welcome to Drive Through HR. Brian, William, Manisha coming to you live every day. Well, let's get to our guest. Been a little while since we've heard from him. Can't wait to catch up. Welcome back to Drive Through HR, Mr. Mark Spelzner.
Hey, thanks, Brian. Pleasure to be here.
Well, my friend, if you would introduce yourself to our family of listeners, and then we'll get rocking right into it.
Great. Sounds good. Good morning or afternoon, everybody. My name is Mark Stelzner. I'm the principal and founder of a boutique consultancy called IAHR, headquartered here in beautiful downtown San Francisco.
Well, excellent, man. So what's been a little while. Good to hear that incredibly flowing voice for everybody listening. It's mesmerizing. So what's kind of keeping you up these days? Tell us a little bit. Actually, before we do that, tell us exactly what your consultancy does.
I think it's a
great place to start.
No, it's a good question. I don't think a lot of people really know what we do. We're relatively quiet about our work, but we're a group of fairly senior practitioners, consultants, advisors, former vendors, et cetera, that really do three things for very, very large employers. Our average client has about 15 to 20,000 employees, typically a U.S.-based multinational, and we're brought in often by the C-suite to attack three problems. One is helping them develop business cases for HR change. So whether one is looking at changing processes, policies, vendors, operational strategies, anything associated with either local or global human capital service delivery, we're helping present those strategies, do the P&L analysis, the IRR, and, of course, the soft and hard benefits of progressing organizations down that path, and then co-presenting to the CEO, CFO board, typically with the CHRO, which leads into our second group of services, which are really selection strategies. So we do a ton of vendor selection across benefits, core HR, payroll, talent management, or some combination therein. And then the last and rapidly growing line of business we have is project management. And we're not a system integrator because that would, in effect, create a conflict of interest since we are agnostic in attempting to be the independent arbiter of goodwill in assessing what providers can offer in the market. But we're actually the project manager for the client side of these deployments to make sure that all the benefits that were memorialized in the business case and all the promises that were made by the service provider community during the selection process are actually deployed and instantiated and supported all the way through to go live. And that's all that we do. So we're quick, we're candid, we're transparent, and our goal is to really facilitate sustainable outcomes and then get the hell out of the way and let these organizations get onto the good work that they do.
Do you help people negotiate contracts?
We do, yeah. So we're brought in if a relationship is starting to break, we do a lot of remediations. If it's a net new relationship or an extension, we may do a market pricing, or we may actually be negotiating just core terms and conditions across all of the subdomains that I described earlier.
So vendor selection has always been a curious business to me, and people have tried, and people have done it, and have done this type of work in our space for a long time. How do you remain agnostic? I mean, I love the theory, and I love analysts that are both independent and objective, et cetera. But, you know, it's hard. It's got to be hard. I mean, I don't know the insides of your business, so I don't know exactly what vendors you work with, et cetera. But I can't help but think that it's got to be difficult, even though, like, you know what works. At the end of the day, you've worked with, I mean, we'll just pick somebody out of the cloud, Workday. Okay, fantastic firm. You know them probably better than the, you know, at least 95% of the population. You know where it works, and you also know where some of the bodies are buried, et cetera. Like, you're agnostic, but you know when a client says, I want this, 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 and this, you know that really they should go with Workday. At the end of the day, yeah, they should go ahead and look at Ultimate, and they should look at Ceridian, and they should look at this, that, and the other. But really for what they're looking for, can you be still at that point, after knowing all the things that you know, can you truly be agnostic?
No, it's a great question. I guess there's a couple things that we've experienced. You know, I've been running this firm for about 8.5 years now and been in the market for about 20. So I think the good and bad of having seen these vendors with all their warts and in all their glory is that every single one of them has failed horrifically, and every single one of them has succeeded with shining colors. And so at the end of the day, you have to recognize that it's not really a matter of whether there are good or bad vendors. It's a matter, as you've really described, whether there's a good or bad fit for certain organizations. And really what we've tried to do is we're actually trying to move away from RFP processes, because we find that this creates an artificial barrier between the buyers and sellers in this market, and that really feature functionality, yes, there are some differences in capabilities in a domain like, let's say, core HR between Workday and Ultimate and Fusion and others. But where relationships really start to break down is in the personalities, is in the behaviors, is in the cultures of the organizations, and it's a lot of the soft stuff. So, frankly, many of these vendors wouldn't be in the market, wouldn't be formidable if they couldn't do many of the capabilities that are required in each of their areas. But our need to remain agnostic comes from the fact that we've come in the breaking point of every single one of these vendors. We've had to kill contracts. We've had to rebid relationships. And at the same time, we recognize that whatever look we had at a vendor, the next day the vendor has changed. Because the evolution of our market now is so rapid, with the rapid infusion of R&D, tons of M&A activity, it's impossible for anyone, analyst, provider, consultant, buyer, even the providers themselves, to truly represent the current state other than that day and that point in time. So if you come in my opinion, and this is really something we carry across the firm, with some preconceived notion of whether a vendor is a good or bad fit, although obviously there are some things that maybe are known to winnow the list down to the known universe, you have to recognize almost an etch-a-sketch approach and put fresh eyes on, because the organization has moved and your clients are moving. And so it's really a matter of who can move in the same direction and really look at a 3 to 5 year term, and that's about as far as you can go out. So I'm not sure if I answered your question, William, but it is a challenge. But you have to give fresh eyes, because the information is no longer current the moment you heard it.
You did a fantastic job. Do you believe that practitioners/buyers should meet their implementation teams before they sign a contract?
Without a doubt. And I think this has to do a lot with the speed and agility of decision-making, frankly. So putting on my provider hat, it's risky to take resources in a selection process and put them in front of a buyer, because a buyer may fall in love. And, in fact, that's what you're hoping, is that a buyer would fall in love with your project management team, your technical leads, your functional leads, et cetera, and draw that connective tissue. But if you as a buyer have an inability to make a very quick and meaningful decision to move from selection into implementation, those same resources are being pitched to 5 or 6 other clients, and it becomes first come, first serve. So you have to be careful that you can set an expectation in terms of timing, decision making, what constitutes selection. Is it letter of intent? Is it actually a contract award? And how much sway do you have in actually locking down either those dedicated or designated resources throughout an implementation? But the need to sit across the table from the folks that will be caring for your implementation, and perhaps even more importantly, your ongoing relationship management and governance, is absolutely paramount.
Yeah, it's implementations are going to go badly. That's just a force of life. It's a question of what happens when they go badly and how do we respond. I want to get your, and Brian, I talked about this pre-show, but we want to get your unvarnished take on RFPs.
Yeah, it's a tough one. There are certainly benefits to RFPs in the sense of having a defensible, memorialized document that states clearly and concisely what you can and can't do. Although the hope is that those documents, much like contracts, get dusty over time, having an RFP response to refer back to determine whether or not a provider is actually living up to their stated or committed capabilities can be quite helpful for certain organizations. And we found, obviously, in highly regulated environments, an RFP is a must. And certainly if procurement is playing a material role in the selection process, based on the size and scope and sheer magnitude of these selections and dollars in play, they may necessitate an RFP. But we started to move to something we call facilitated selections because we believe what's most important and what RFPs often create a challenge around is assumptions, and that there's just not enough information sharing. There's just not enough face time, and that this creates an artificial wall between the two entities, and that if we can do workshops instead, and we can actually kick over every stone and start to winnow down, you're always going to have to make assumptions until you get an implementation, but winnow that down to a manageable list and make sure that both parties have had a chance to truly address one another, ask questions, really understand the operational culture. I was down at an emerging auto manufacturer who's in the news quite a bit these days just yesterday, and they're going through a payroll selection. And that culture is moving so fast. These people are going to hire 3,000 employees in the next 6 months. It's booming. And so if you come in with an RFP and you use your standard processes and approaches, what you're not going to get a sense of is the need for someone to move at the same speed of that organization, and that the implementation team and the unspoken expectations of deployment will be working 24/7 for the next 6 months to get this system live. And despite our best efforts to try to capture those cultural nuances in an RFP document, it's only when you sit down across the table from those that are governing this process internally and will ultimately own the outcome that you really get a sense of what the true priorities end up being. So I'd like to see us as an industry move further and further away from RFPs so that we can break down some of these barriers.
So if you believe in SLAs, should SLAs be two-way?
It's a great question. Expound on that just a little bit.
So a lot of times when you're talking to practitioners, they want to make sure that the vendor does, that adheres to the project plan and the deadlines and the thingamabobs, et cetera. But the vendors also need certain things from practitioners, let's say data, as a for instance.
Right.
And if they don't get that in a timely manner, then it affects their timeline. Yet they're often the ones that have the tough SLAs in their contracts. So, first of all, do you like SLAs? Like, do you just like SLAs in general? And if so, do you think that they should be bidirectional?
Yeah, let me take them one at a time. So I think SLAs have a purpose, and it's more about reporting than it is enforcement. And I think that that's where the rub has come. So most SLAs are considered to be penalizing the provider community for a lack of performance, when in fact the benefit that comes from SLAs is just agreeing on a cadence of performance reporting so one can take the temperature of the presumed health of the relationship. But the reality, unfortunately, is that your SLAs can be green, but your mood can be red. So you can have providers that meet every single SLA, but at the end of the day, you're still very dissatisfied because there are things that SLAs simply don't measure, the subjective measures about how you're feeling about your account executive, how you're feeling about responsiveness to inquiries or innovation or notification, things that would never be memorialized in typical terms like speed to answer or sanctity of file feeds or things of that nature. So we have seen some providers actually move to the equivalent of a net promoter score, a subjective measurement on a quarterly basis that says, you know, on a scale of 1 to 5, are you happy or unhappy? Because really at the end of the day, that's the metric that really matters in terms of the sustainability of that relationship. So that's kind of item one. So I like SLAs for the rigor associated with reporting on perhaps key metrics. I don't like SLAs necessarily as an enforcement mechanism over time. In terms of bidirectional SLAs, I think it's actually a pretty compelling notion. Because I think clients pragmatically recognize the fact that if they don't meet their obligations, that the implementation or ongoing relationship may fail. And what we've started to do is do what we call implementation readiness to try to pull up some of those issues as early in the process as possible to make sure that the client understands their commitments, their resource allocation, because the reality is they're probably trying to do this off the edge of their desk while they're keeping their previously poor processes alive. And the providers are clearly codependent on the practitioners and experts scattered across this enterprise to do their yeoman's work to make sure that this thing actually works. And so, you know, I'd be curious to see how we would figure out how to measure that, but I like the notion of it. I think it would make sense to put something like that in the implementation plan. And I think subtly many providers have done so to basically say, listen, if we don't get this first feed or test file by date X, the project's going to slip. But, of course, what's missing from that, William, is any enforcement mechanism.
Right.
So, yeah, it's a great notion, though.
So, Brian and I want to get your take on consultants and outsourced implementations. And the thought of this kind of came to us is, should software firms be great at implementations, or should consultants be great at those implementations?
Yeah, and I think the confusion right now is what is a software firm versus what is an outsourcer. And I think I think generally there's a problem with nomenclature in our industry. You walk the floor of any of our, you know, wonderful shows and events that occur, and everyone's using the same language. And I think it's very difficult for buyers to sort of deconstruct and demystify the edges of technology providers versus full service and solution providers. I think software companies should be good at training implementation providers, right? So I think, you know, you go back to Workday. Workday's made it very clear through their ecosystem strategy that they have elected to focus on software, not deployment. And they have come up with a very persistent and consistent mechanism by which they can audit their third-party ecosystem providers and train them and give them the tools they need to be successful. And I think that model is probably poorly understood by the buyer community, but certainly makes sense in the construct of what an organization like Workday is attempting to accomplish. I think service organizations, those that are truly providing outsourcing services, whether it's, you know, payroll outsourcing, benefits outsourcing, total HR outsourcing, or some combination therein, must create a service orientation that draws no distinction, if you will, between the software solution and the service solution. Because what we found when relationships break is it's the finger pointing between those who configured the technology versus those that are actually administering the day-to-day transactions. And so I'd like to see more rigor generally around project management and implementation. I'd like to see more true estimates of the level of time and effort that clients need to bring forward, because I think in the sales process, everyone's trying to minimize the amount of work that clients need to do. But at the end of the day, it's a Herculean effort. You're talking about a major transformation if it's done correctly. And so we need to spend more time, I think, as an industry, really focusing on project management and implementation, much like you're asking.
So would it shock you to learn that there are 22,000 HR and recruiting software products in the world?
It would not.
How do you keep track of it all? How do you and all of your competent staff keep up with the madness? Because I want your secrets, damn it.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is it's an impossible task. And as a, you know, relatively small but rapidly growing organization, that's one of the rubs, honestly, is really the emerging providers get lost. The specialty providers, those that have elected to focus on one subcomponent of one subdomain of our wonderful HR market, often are challenged to get airtime with the types of Fortune 1000 clients that we deal with. And so we end up probably focusing on maybe 100 to 150 of the service providers versus the thousands that you're speaking to. Now, part of that is, realistically speaking, that of those 22,000, let's say, there may only be a few thousand who really are targeting the types of enterprise clients that we're focused on today. But at the end of the day, there's really not a good or simple answer, because you could spend every day, every hour of every day, of every week, of every year, getting briefed on providers and their benefits and their positioning and their differentiators and still never keep up. And so that's a challenge I think we have to deal with on a day-to-day basis. And we often meet new providers in the throes of our work by virtue of the fact that they've already built inroads with the clients that we're servicing. So we don't come with a preconceived notion of who's in or out. We know who we know. But we have to be open to the entry of new providers, because it's a daunting task to think about how you can stay abreast of this. And true analysts, you know, we're not a traditional analyst firm, but true analysts, I don't know how they do it. And I know the ones that I've met have bags under their eyes that are perhaps a little bigger than yours and mine. But It's an endless and unsustainable task, and I wish I had a better answer.
So I've said to audiences before that acquisitions are great for guys like me or for guys like you or Brian, but they're actually terrible for practitioners. Now, that's, of course, being outlandish and typical 10-cap form, I'd say. But what do you think about acquisitions? Are they good for buyers? Are they bad for buyers? Like, what should we know as practitioners about the M&A market?
And this is specifically about acquisitions of service providers?
Yeah, yeah, vendor to vendor.
Vendor to vendor, great question. Yeah, I think the real challenge is, one, what is the roadmap? And I think this is the most basic question one can ask and the most complex question for the acquiring entity and the acquired entity to answer. Some acquisitions, as you know, William, happen because of customers. You're buying a market. Some happen because of features. You're buying capabilities. Some happen because of geographies. You're buying entry into a new area or language or capability that just simply didn't exist by virtue of your geographic focus. And so I think what's difficult for buyers is to understand, regardless of whether they had invested in the acquiring or acquired entity, what is the future of that product? Is that going to be integrated into a net new service? Is that something that's going to be retired, supported as long as necessary, but really with either a forced or a gentle prodded migration? I think acquisitions are good in the sense that our buyers are trying to rationalize their vendor ecosystem. So if you think about the clients that we service, take, let's say, a 130,000-person hospitality client that we have. They've probably got about 120 HR service providers across the globe that are servicing them today. So to the extent that those providers combine, or some of those providers combine, and therefore the day-to-day relationship management and governance becomes easier, the number of contracts to manage becomes smaller, the number of individuals to have to contact to control for all these different subcomponents or feature sets becomes smaller, that really can be perceived to be quite beneficial to the client. On the contrary, if you went through a selection process and chose provider X over provider Y, and provider X gets subsumed by provider Y, you may want to exit that relationship very quickly, and you may realize that, you know what, I culturally or for other reasons, I didn't pick provider Y, and now I'm being forced to work with them beyond my control. And so there are so many key considerations, but it's really about transparency. It's about the future vision, and it's about being able to clearly articulate the reason for the acquisition and what that really means to the client for the near and long term.
Question from the Twitter sphere. Your take, again, unvarnished take on big data. What do you actually, separate the myth and all the hype and all the other madness, what do you actually see out there in the market?
Yeah, I think big data has caught much more airtime than it warrants, to be perfectly honest with you. I think buyers are seeing very little value-based representation of how big data is actually impacting their day-to-day lives. I think we're seeing it starting to emerge in a couple areas, and I'll focus on healthcare reform for just a moment. So if we look at the exchange providers, the Ann Hewitts, Towers Watsons, Buck Xerox, et cetera, folks of that ilk, who are really governing millions and millions of relationships, their ability to potentially look at health data, actual claims and health data, to drive behavioral interventions, behavioral changes, or perhaps pro-offer interventions at a right point in time based on their ability to mine your true claims data and pharmacy data, although that sounds scary and invasive maybe to some people, can not only drive costs but can help save lives. And so there are examples like that within the big data world that I think can be incredibly compelling. If one looks at some of the talent strategies, and I'm not talking about performance and comp, but I'm talking about, let's say, relocation strategies or geo strategies. If I'm a Fortune 1000, I'm going to enter Malaysia. The fact that there are providers in the market today that have very, very deep and detailed data pools that can determine the education and population that is truly available for hiring in-country, if in fact I elect to enter that geography, is incredibly compelling. But I think the problem is big data as a notion is meaningless without concrete examples such as the ones we just described. So I'd like to see the conversation shift away from everyone being a quote-unquote big data provider and the value of big data generically, to more specific value-based examples of how clients can pragmatically use big data to their advantage. It can actually save cost, improve agility, do all the things that the theory of big data allegedly would provide.
So when you get asked platform versus point solution, how do you respond, A, and how do you help practitioners navigate how they look at the software world?
Yeah, it's really a discussion on trade-offs and relative prioritization. I mean, one of the things that we end up doing when we come in early in the process is we do a ton of process mapping. We try to get underneath how people actually do the work that they do today, which is a very enlightening exercise. It's a long exercise, but enlightening exercise for the clients. And what they realize, I think, at the end of those processes is what is truly the priority? Because if you go to a platform place, so let's talk about talent, right? Let's talk about an integrated solution for onboarding, recruiting, learning, leadership development, succession planning, performance comp, et cetera. There is no one perfect provider that provides all of those subcomponents in the talent suite today. They all started from an anchor tenancy of learning or performance or comp or subcombination therein. And so when you get into the specialization within each of these subdomains, you start to realize that there is going to have to be a give and take if you move to a platform. The benefits, of course, single solution, single user interface, single data interface, presumably if they've reached their holistic nirvana that the providers are obviously geared toward for enterprise talent management. But you also realize is that they have to spend their R&D dollars wisely, and that the lack of benefit, if you will, of large enterprise providers is they can't really mature all of their subdomains as quickly as you may want to see. So really, client by client, what's more important? And if you find, let's say, in learning, that you have a strong, strong learning environment, we have a large retail client that has about 14,000 employees, and we talk to them about enterprise talent versus core learning management. And what they realize is although they would love to get to an end-to-end enterprise talent management solution, learning is substantial enough and material enough to the education of their team members in their stores that it justifies a standalone solution, and that the flexibility and feature and functionality and usability is so core to their profitability and the usability of their employees on a day-to-day basis that justifies a point solution, despite the fact that they'd love to see a holistic end-to-end solution. So it really comes down to a trade-off analysis, but you have to understand sort of what your destination is and where you're starting from and what's your prioritization now and where would you be headed 2 or 3 years from now so that you set them down the right path.
Mark, what's something that practitioners, if they're jumping into any technology decision within their kind of purview, what should they be asking? What's the one thing they have to ask or they're going to set themselves up for a lot of pain?
I think they have to ask about the future. I keep coming back to this idea of R&D and roadmap. I think many people are assessing the providers based on where they are today or where they've been in the past. So have you worked with like-kind organizations? Do you support companies of our size, scope, and complexity? Do you support our, retailers or manufacturers or what have you? And although that's important just to show prior body of experience or some affinity to the organization and ability to hit the ground running, it's really a question of where are you headed? Where are you strategically investing? Where are you organically or inorganically growing? What languages or capabilities will you be adding for hyper-localization, for globalization? I want to see buyers spend more time asking about the future because at the end of the day, that buyer organization is evolving in all those same ways. They're having to require flexibility and elasticity that may supersede the future vision of the organization. So if you're always looking at providers through the lens of today and you're not really mapping this to your strategic plan, do you know your strategic plan, number one, and do you know what the growth strategy coming out of your C-suite truly is? So you can try to assess the future match. Because in some respects, where that provider's headed is much, much more important than where they are today, and that's why I think these relationships tend to break downstream.
Well, Mark, fantastic. Great information, great conversation as usual. Where can folks connect with you on the interwebs? And we get through that, and we're wrapped up for today.
Great. Well, thanks, guys. Wonderful conversation. Appreciate the opportunity. Look forward to coming back at another time. I'm on Twitter at Stelzner. That's STELZNER, and you can check out our website at www.ia-hr.com, and just Google Stelzner and you'll find me. Thanks, everybody.